I want to welcome Agile XRM to the podcast. I've known the people at Agile XRM for the past 12 years. I've seen how their business process management tool can add massive value to complex organizational processes in sectors such as finance and government. If you have complex processes or a need for dialogues on the Power Platform or Dynamics 365, take a look at how this BPM tool can add value. You can find them at agilexrm.com or check out the show notes for more details. Welcome to the Power 365 show. Full show notes for this episode can be found at nz365guy.com/228. Before we chat with today's guest, here's a quick message from our sponsors. Today's show has been brought to you by me. My career has spanned over 20 years in IT and 16 of those in Microsoft business applications. I've worked in multiple countries, employed many staff and grown practices. I'm now offering career and business coaching. Express your interest today at nz365guy.com/coaching. Today's guest is from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. He's the Principal Program Manager Lead of PowerCAT at Microsoft. He is a course creator and trainer. He's a co-author of two books on BizTalk. You can find him on Twitter at Wearsy, that is W-E-A-R-S-Y. Welcome to the show, Kent Weir.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Do you want to correct anything that I said in the intro there, as in you're still in that role within Microsoft?
Yeah, you know, you did pretty well. Technically, it's three books, but
Oh, wow. There you go. There you go. Awesome.
Who's counting? And yeah, so I am a lead on the PowerCAT team. There are a few of us, mm-hmm. but I focus on Power Automate and robotic process automation and Power Virtual Agents. So yeah, that was pretty close though.
I love it. Okay, so I always like to kind of get some background on my guests coming in. So can you tell us a bit about, you know, family, food, and fun, all those things that you do when you're not thinking about Microsoft and work?
Family, food, and fun. Okay, sounds good. So family-wise, I've married and mm-hmm. Have two daughters. So they recently had birthdays, so they're 9 and 11. They're very different, which is kind of interesting to see. One is very athletic and, mm-hmm. and very much into sports, which I'm also very into that. And the other one is more into technology, which I'm also very into. But like their interests vary greatly, like across the two of them. So it's nice to have something in common with each of them that is sort of unique from that perspective. So that's the mm-hmm. the family side of thing. I would say food, generally pretty diverse. Like I do enjoy Indian food. I do enjoy mm-hmm. sushi. Actually, not as much of the sort of typical Western diet. Maybe that's too much of that growing up. But generally do enjoy you know, a wide variety of food. And then fun-wise, big into sports, as I mentioned before, really enjoy live sports. So, especially once we can, you know, enjoy those once again. But
American, any specifically?
Yeah, well, American and Canadian football.
Nice.
I'm not so much into soccer, although I do enjoy watching my daughter play soccer. Baseball, a little bit of hockey. And then also I try to keep in shape by running. So I've been able to complete four of the major marathons.
Wow.
It's been difficult to get into these remaining two, obviously with COVID, but those are definitely on my bucket list. So
wow, that is intense. Like I know, you know, to prep for marathons, it's some serious prep work to, you know, that has to go into play there.
It's like another job, right? Like it really is. And it's like I enjoy running, I really do, but like it's kind of like once you're at that 15k, 15 kilometers, almost 10 miles, like it's no longer fun after that. And then you know when you know that you have to put in the work because otherwise you're going to pay for it dearly on race day, that's when it's not a lot of fun. When you need to go out and run and force yourself to run like 20-30k on a, you know, weekend. And then, like, after that, you're spent, you're shot. It's, like, pretty much nap time and couch time, and that's pretty much it. So
what do you got mainly playing on your headphones when you're in a race? And do you create, like, a mix that that kind of helps you at different points that you know you'll be at from a mental and physical point of view?
So that's a great question. So I would say to a certain extent, yes. So I have to run with music. If someone said you can't run with music, and this was a little bit of a debate a few years back, like I wouldn't do it. There's no way. Like I need music to keep going. And I would say I probably first the shorter races, maybe where I kind of feel like, okay, like 10K, you know, around this time, I'm going to need a little bit of a lift. Maybe I put like Rise Against up there or something, you know, that's going to really sort of get the juices going. Maybe I'll do a little bit of that. But I'd say nothing too much, nothing too coordinated. I would say sometimes it's important to have some of the calmer music at the beginning, because especially in the longer races, you don't want to get out too fast. That's where you pay dearly. So I don't go too hardcore, but I definitely, you know, have a good variety of music, and just, you know, if you like it, you like it. So I typically live by that. So
I just wondered, like, if I got into doing something like that, would I try to coordinate the beats per minute, you know, to line up my heart, my pace, all that kind of stuff, you know, to see if that would give me any enhancement or, keep me going at the right points.
Sure. Yeah. No, it makes sense. It's a lot of work. So.
So true. So before we crack into, you know, your career background and how you got to where you are, tell me about PowerCat. What is this team inside Microsoft?
Okay, yeah, sure. So the CAT, other than sounding like a cool name, stands for Customer Advisory Team. And so we focus on Power Platform Technologies. And I will clarify, there is a separate Power BI CAT team. So they're like a relative of us, but they're not sort of in our direct leadership chain. And so I guess this starts a few years back, especially around like Power Apps, when Power Apps was becoming a thing. And as companies were starting to adopt it, they did need some help with that. And so Saurabh Pant, who I report to, he's one of the charter members of PowerCat. And then there's a few other familiar folks as well. Pratap, which I'm sure you've run into, and Mehdi and Samir. Some of those are the longer standing members of PowerCat. They really started it all, and then since then it's really expanded as the Power Platform has as well. And so our goal is generally to work with strategic customers in a post-sales capacity to really help them get over the finish line, really realize the benefits of their purchase, their investment. And what is a little bit interesting about the team is we do sit inside of engineering, like we're not considered like a consulting team. We do want to ensure that we are bringing in that feedback to the product group and really helping customers influence the roadmap. And so Samir really, you know, probably says this the best, right? We kind of sit in this middle and become advocates in both directions, right? So in many respects, we're advocates for the customers and representing their interests when we talk with product and engineering. And then on the flip side, when we're working with customers, we really become advocates for the product and engineering org and really sort of, sit in between, those two groups. On top of that, we're obviously very interested in building community. So community is a big part of PowerCat as well. There's a group called Champions. And really, these are folks that are really like fire starters inside of organizations, doing really interesting things, really trying to spread the love of the Power Platform. And we certainly want to recognize those people and empower them and actually make sure they've got the right levels of tools and information to help them do more. Naturally, that's in everyone's best interest if they're doing more. But it's not just about technology. I'd say this team is also focused on the person. And, you know, it's really interesting to see some of these folks that may not come from, you know, your traditional IT background, but really create opportunities and carve out interesting careers for themselves as a result of being involved in this technology set. And so that's a pretty interesting part of what our team does as well, and another focus.
I like it. Now, you had a bit of an interesting journey, is that you're a Microsoft MVP and then you've joined Microsoft. Tell us about that journey. I hear MVPs talk about, you know, how do they lose MVP? And it's kind of like, well, you can blue badge, you can become a Microsoft employee, you can break NDA. Those are around, Or you can stop contributing, you know, or adding value to the community are really the three ways of exiting the MVP program. Now, you know, you've obviously taken probably one of the best ways to exit the program. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, certainly better than the alternative.
Yeah, so. Yeah. You don't want to be kicked for NDA violation.
No, certainly not. My journey starts quite a while ago. So I don't know, probably let me look at my trophy here, like 2008, 2009 timeframe. Mm-hmm. And I got involved in a community related to BizTalk. So BizTalk server, which is a lot of that on-premises, like system integration, middleware type technology. Yeah. And it was something where I was working for the federal government of Canada at the time, and I had the opportunity to learn a new skill. And, you know, I'm very passionate about technology. I love learning, and just I basically took it. And then as a result, like BizTalk was still in its infancy back then. And you really did lean on the web in order to learn, right? And certainly, like, especially back then, like MSDN forms was kind of the go-to place. And I found that, you know, I was just so interested in the technology. I was learning from these forms. And then I found, like, I was able to start contributing. And so that sort of started getting me more involved in the community. And then, you know, I started picking up blogging. It's one of those things where I truly do enjoy writing, especially, like, documentation. I seriously enjoy it. And so that was just sort of natural in terms of, you know, blogging and the forums. And then, you know, sure enough, like there was opportunities to speak at a .NET user group here in Calgary. And then it just started to spiral. And I was lucky to be nominated by a guy at Microsoft named Clint Huffman, who was a BizTalk PFE at the time. And he had nominated me to get into the program. And I was lucky enough to get in. And then really enjoyed it. And I think the best part of the program, without a doubt, is just the people you do meet. And those people can be Microsoft people, but they are also in the community. And I've just been so lucky and even blessed to meet the people I have. And it's been, like, super awesome. Like, it's these people have become lifelong friends from all over the world. I've, you know, visited them at their house. They've come and visited me. Mm-hmm. I've attended their weddings. Like one of them, Steph Jan, we've run two marathons together.
Wow.
Berlin and New York City. And so it's just, it's truly such a unique community. And I think there's, like, some common characteristics of MVPs. And I think a lot of it just has to do with, you know, these contributions and this idea of, like, you're kind of doing it for the greater good. And generally, there's not a lot of selfish MVPs. They're genuinely interested in helping people. And I feel, as a result, you tend to meet some really high quality people as a result. And it's truly been game changing for me. I think, you know, in terms of joining Microsoft, it certainly created opportunities for exposure to really meet some of these other folks inside of Microsoft. And I feel like that definitely had created an opportunity, or certainly helped get in the door with Microsoft, because, you know, I had known these people and sort of had a body of work that people could lean on from beyond just a day's interview.
Yeah. So how hard was that decision to, you know, forgo MVP and go into Microsoft? Because, you know, it's definitely a decision that I have toyed with more than once as the opportunity is presented. How easy was it for you to go, you know, because obviously for those listening, you can't be an MVP as well as be a Microsoft employee. How difficult was that decision?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say, yeah, it was certainly hard, but I feel like it would be much harder to leave and join a different tech company.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Alexa's going off here.
That's all right.
but I don't know what I said to trigger that. But I feel like if I was to join Amazon or if I was to join Google, I feel like that would be a much harder sort of transition because you truly feel like you are leaving that community behind. Mm-hmm. And I feel like within Microsoft, it's a little bit different in the sense that you will be doing different things, but you're still plugged into the community. And it's kind of interesting, you know, like, part of some of these, MVP groups that I'm still involved in now, whether it's, like, informal, like on WhatsApp or, you know, Twitter DMs. And so you're still, like, plugged in with those people. Obviously, just sort of the role you play becomes a little bit different. So I feel like it's less of an issue there. You know, you can always, you know, become an MVP again. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. But I feel like it's just a little bit different, right? Where before, oftentimes people, it's a bit of a hobby, to be frank. And now it becomes more of your job. And so sometimes you do want to unplug, right? Because you're too close to it. And you do truly value your weekend where, you know, I don't know how many times I've spent my entire weekend, you know, building out, you know, community content and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you do need a little bit of a break as well.
Yeah. So talking on that, right, you've written the three books. I see also on Udemy you've created courses. And the art of course creation is quite different than just delivering training. Like you can be an instructor, but you didn't necessarily create the content. In this case, you've done both, you know, being the instructor as well as the course creator. What was your, you know, what was that like for you and what was involved? And for those that, you know, that might be listening that are interested in putting together their own courses and things like that, any recommendations or advice?
Ah, that's another good one. I think, you know, for me, it was, I would call it a little bit of an extension of some of the community work that I was doing. Mm-hmm. So there was something that I did when I was an MVP with a buddy, Steph Jan, who I mentioned before, called Middleware Friday. And so him and I, every Friday, we would take turns and essentially put out a video on Microsoft integration. So some of that was BizTalk, some of that was Azure Logic App, some of that mm-hmm. was Microsoft Flow at the time. And so I feel like I had a fair amount of experience like behind the mic, behind the camera, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. always trying to think of like sort of new ways to deliver some sort of content. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that was, that certainly helped me in sort of going down this journey itself. And I feel like it's just another one of those things where I really like, you know, creating content. Like I truly love it. And I think for me, I've just been really fascinated by this whole YouTube generation. And even, mm-hmm. you know, some friends where they've, you know, gone the Pluralsight route and
that's
been
right.
very mm-hmm. successful with it. And I felt like for me, I'm very much, I need to do in order to learn. Like I'm a learn by doing kind of person. And I felt like this would be just a good opportunity to sort of experience that and actually put something together that was mine. Like there was no one to blame but myself if mm-hmm. this thing went poorly. And obviously if it went well, then, you know, I can take all the credit too, selfishly, but like that was part of the reason why I went down the Udemy route. Like I really felt like I wanted to put my stamp on this. I wanted mm-hmm. to explore and I really had nothing to lose, right? Like I was still, you know, working my full-time job. I was still doing MVP activities and this was an opportunity for me to really go ahead and just sort of learn more about digital marketing and learn mm-hmm. more about what people are looking for and try to understand like what is the style that people are interested in and the type of content themselves. Mm-hmm. And so it was something where it was probably more of a fun thing than anything else. Yes, I have made some money off of it, but certainly nothing to write home about it from that perspective. But it was really a great learning journey for me. And I think how I approached it was essentially built out all of the content and demos beforehand. So I feel like a lot of planning. And then just breaking it up and just recording it. And, you know, I spent a good part of a long weekend recording it mm-hmm. and really just sort of breaking it up into manageable chunks because, like, you do have to have energy. You can't just sort of let the energy just, like, you know, die. You can't sound boring. You have to be excited because there's some feedback I received earlier in my career, like if you're not excited about this, no one else is going to be.
Exactly.
And so
true.
You do have to take some breaks and, you know, go for that run and, you know, mm-hmm. play some music and have some coffee and really, you know, ensure that you're motivated to do it. Because if you're not motivated, you might as well just hit the pause button and revisit it when you are.
Yeah, totally. That makes sense to me. It's funny you say there about making money but, you know, not being much. And for years, you know, in the MVP community, people commented that why were books counted as a contribution when, you know, if you wrote a tech book or something, it was counted as a contribution, but you're paid for it. And at the end of the day, you know, the amount of hours and effort to write a book and a tech book particularly I'm talking about here, as well as, you know, create courses like this, any money that you get doesn't even begin to cover the costs of your time, let alone, you know, any other kind of tooling, et cetera, you had to get to do it?
Oh, 100%. And obviously there's going to be some exceptions to the rule, but in general, yeah, I totally agree with that. Like the books that I wrote, you know, it is funny. I still get some of these like very small royalty checks that come in every quarter, but it's like, yeah, I'll go buy like a Happy Meal, right? Like it's
exactly
to write home about at this point in time. But
yeah. I was talking to another MVP that wrote a book years ago. And I said, listen, if you added all the royalty checks up for the entire, and this was maybe over 10 years on since writing that book, I said, what does it come to? And he said, $18,000. And I said, $18,000. And I said, and how many hours did you spend writing it? Because it was a massive, massive book, tech book that he'd written. And it took him like over a year to write. And he used to spend all his evenings, weekends, that type of thing. And so the actual hourly rate didn't even come close to being economical.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And that's something that you do, you know, you need to go in like with that mindset. You need to, it needs to be one of those like passion projects because, yeah, you won't be doing it for the money unless you're sort of in that, you know, that small minority and you're really talking about something that has like some very significant broad appeal. And certainly BizTalk was, it was like highly valuable because they weren't a ton of resources, but also that pool of resources was also quite small as well. And so that was part of the reason why I did go the co-author route as well. Like with all of the books, there was an element of co-authorship. And that was part of it, right? One was to get the experience. Like I truly feel people need to explore. They need to try things. And this was a lower impact or lower effort route of going to do that. And I know sometimes, you know, readers don't always enjoy that because you do have different writing styles. And so you do need to be aware of that and make sure you've got some consistency when you go about doing that. But I always felt like that was a good plan for me. To get the experience, you know, everyone likes to, you know, have a book, you know, on their shelf that they can, you know, show their parents and, you know, and that sort of thing. And it's a nice feeling. But it was really just, you know, going about that experience and having to do that. And like I said before, I do enjoy writing. So it didn't feel like too much of a chore, but certainly as soon as you have timelines, you know, that's when the rubber hits the road and you really have to, you know, you have to get the work in.
Yeah, so true. So true. So let's switch gears and talk about Soft Emotive, Win Automation Platform. You know, Microsoft's acquired it. How was it, 4 or 5 months ago now?
Yeah, it would have been that May, June timeframe when it closed. Yeah, so just a couple months ago,
And, of course, today we're recording on day two of Ignite. And so, you know, there's been a bunch of new announcements come out. But before we go down there, can you tell me about Soft Emotive, you know, what was acquired, what's really going to be turned into tangible outcomes that you can talk about?
Yeah, sure. And yeah, I'll just take a step back and, you know, just maybe give a bit of history around RPA at Microsoft here. So we did release what's called UI Flows, which was essentially Microsoft's robotic process automation offering as part of Power Automate back in April. So it did reach general availability and it did provide some RPA capabilities, especially around recording, the ability to record a set of actions and then have an automation script that you can inject different basically parameters or inputs and then basically run it. And so that was, you know, let's call it step one. And then naturally with, you know, any first release, like you're never going to hit like all of the capabilities, right? Especially when you're building a service, you innovate, you add, you know, whether that's, you know, biweekly releases, weekly releases, quarterly releases, like you're continuing to invest. And so Soft Emotive, you know, was seen as an opportunity and you know, I wasn't part of that acquisition team, so I'm sure there's some other things at play that I'm not aware of. But in general, Soft Emotive had been in this space for quite some time, you know, 10 years plus time. So like this is something where RPA was, you know, very mature inside of their product, which is called Win Automation, the desktop automation piece. And so it did provide Microsoft with some capabilities that we were like some gaps. It did fill some gaps that, that were there. And, you know, and it really became like this opportunity to complement, you know, what had already been built in the cloud inside of Power Automate. And so what happened when the acquisition closed in I guess it would have been late June, there was a very quick, what was called 0.5 integration, or V.5 of the integration released, and that allowed you to call a WinAutomation script from Power Automate through this UI flow connector experience. And so that allowed customers of Softomotive, because they have like many customers, right? Like they've been around 10 plus years, to basically now start to take advantage of Power Automate, and also the flip side, right? Where if you were building API flows previously and you wanted to take advantage of some of these new capabilities in WinAutomation, you'd have that opportunity to do so. And just one example of that is Excel. There's some great support for Excel inside of WinAutomation. And they've got something called actions, which are kind of similar to, you know, actions that you do see in API flows. It's essentially like these reusable kind of functions that you can call, and they do specific things. And so, you know, that would be one scenario where you could take advantage of this, because otherwise you wouldn't necessarily want to record a script around some of the Excel interactions, nor would the current connector in API flows be able to address some of those use cases either. And so that was, you know, sort of the initial foray of like, you know, let's bring WinAutomation and put it together. And I know for some folks, they're kind of like, oh, like, why are they buying this tool? Or is this yet another thing? You know, sometimes Microsoft, you know, we can go ahead and try to solve the problem many different ways in many different routes. And no, like, this is a basically a come together story, right? And so that's what's happened at Ignite here. We recently announced Power Automate Desktop. So technically that was yesterday, so September 22nd. And this is really unifying a lot of those Softomotive investments, the WinAutomation investments, and bringing it under one umbrella, right? So now what happens is when you launch Power Automate Desktop, you're going to see theming that looks much more like a Power Automate than you would have seen in WinAutomation. But now you've got this integration into the cloud as well, right? So naturally, when you build flows and automations, you always want to be able to see your logging, your telemetry, right? Like that's now getting shipped up to the cloud. Application lifecycle management is really important. Like previously, when you had WinAutomation and you had Power Automate, now you have two different types of automations to deploy. Now that's all in one story, right? When you go ahead and build a desktop automation and you click save, well, guess where it's going? It's going up into CDS, right? With the rest of the UI flows. And so now it's really just bringing that experience together. And I'm super excited about it. I think this is truly going to be game changing. It's been crazy even in the 24 hours. Well, it's more like 36 hours that this has been released. Just the interest that has come in, right? So it's been really awesome to see thus far. And, you know, it's only going to get better, right? We're in public preview right now. I won't say too much more than that. But, you know, in the near future, we will be reaching general availability. And naturally, in sort of the Microsoft fashion, we're going to continue to invest and innovate in this space. And I think what's super awesome to see is that in just a short period of time, not only has like the Softomotive acquisition closed, but those people are now at Microsoft, right? And so they're bringing their expertise and their mind share. And now you've got this, you know, an even larger team, you know, solving this problem. And so that's what's super exciting, right? We're really did up our game in terms of like just basically bandwidth in order to like deliver more. But naturally, these folks bring, you know, a wealth of expertise as well.
So that's, you know, that's phenomenal. It's really built that, you know, the whole Power Automate into a solid, you know, tool set. What are the industries that you're commonly seeing jumping on this? And what are some really common use cases or if you like, low-hanging fruit use cases that businesses might, you know, have right now that this really addresses and solves and adds a level of automation to something that would be a repetitive, mundane process?
Yeah, I know that's a great question. I think like industry-wise, like it is kind of interesting. Like we get this question a lot about like, oh, like, you know, give me some industry examples and give me, you know, show me some other use cases in this vertical. And it's almost one of those things where it's fairly agnostic, right? Like naturally, you're going to have some systems which are just being used in that industry and you want to make sure you've got the right level of support. So I get that. But it's really this ability to go ahead and automate applications where APIs are not available, right? So this is typically your legacy applications. They can be web applications. They can be desktop applications. They can be applications that have been virtualized through technologies such as Citrix and Terminal services. And really where like the opportunity for Microsoft is naturally we have all of this expertise in API-led connectivity, right? Like what used to be known as Microsoft Flow and now is Power Automate API flows. We can actually give customers the right tool for the right job. And whether you're going after these like modern applications or you're going after legacy applications, or if you need to do both, you know, right? You need a hybrid approach. You can actually go ahead and do that. And so that's what is unique about our opportunity compared to some of our competitors is we can really give people the best architecture to go and execute on that. But just to make sure I'm not skirting the question, like to give you some specific examples, like energy naturally is you know, as an industry that we do spend a lot of time in, I would say just even consumer goods, retail, healthcare, telecommunications is another one, right? We definitely run into those use cases. And I think, you know, some of the common scenarios is you do have some of these legacy applications that exist in these industries. And as a result, you do need to be able to go ahead and to automate that. And naturally, our goal, you know, with the Power Platform is we want to democratize who can go build those solutions. And so we are going after, you know, building simple experiences that allow, you know, makers of all backgrounds to be able to come and contribute. And certainly that's a goal for us as well. And naturally we want to leverage the cloud where it makes sense as well, right? We want to make sure people can leverage cloud-based orchestration, use connectors, use CDS, be able to plug in a chatbot if you need to with Power Virtual Agents, be able to have a Power Apps portal, maybe as an entry form, and then use RPA on the back end to go ahead and automate the last mile. We want to be able to bring a very much a platform approach to solving automation, regardless of where someone is in their journey.
So you mentioned legacy applications, and sometimes the term legacy does not create any triggers in one's mind as about what you're talking about. And so as you're talking about that, and I was thinking across my career, you know, what type of legacy applications I'd come across. And in my work in federal government, I came across, for example, systems built on IBM backends that were had no concept of APIs. And, you know, particularly I did work around border force, border protection, that type of thing. And when an agent had to update an internal system, they often had to key it into one system, key it into another system, key it into a third system, because none of these systems would talk together. And this is a use case where RPA would absolutely come into play to update those multiple systems that didn't have APIs. And then the next one I can think of is in banking. A lot of back-end and banking infrastructure is, once again, very old technology that can't be changed out easily, but sometimes don't even work with a mouse, you know. So no mouse input. It's a total keyboard driven experience. And so those type of scenarios, is that where you're seeing RPA really come into play, where they are, you know, in these traditional environments? You mentioned telcos is another one, which would have invested a lot of money into applications that they can't change quickly, but they could add this degree of automation to it now with this technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, we see sort of a few different flavors of that, but definitely like those intranet applications have been built maybe in the early 2000s, right, early to mid 2000s, right? Or even late 2000s, where this sort of API first concept didn't quite exist. I would say you've got some of these, like even like, say, these Power Builder applications, right, that may have been built even before that and now are being like virtualized in Citrix is another example. And then I think just ERPs as well. And ERPs, you know, I wouldn't consider like, say, an SAP to be a legacy application necessarily, but it can be fairly expensive and complex to go ahead and to integrate through the back end. Right. You've got connectors, you've got these different layers, you've got basis administration and all these roles. And sometimes it's like, as an end user, if you want to provide that automation, you know the steps you need to do when you're in the screen. You just don't want to be tied up in that swivel chair integration that you just talked about. Right? Where it's kind of like, I want you to just pick up the data from the source system and then go through and, you know, enter data in like fields A, B, and C, then go to the next tab, select the dropdown, do a search, those sorts of things. And to be able to do that in ERP. So ERPs are another you know, big opportunity to improve productivity for organizations, regardless of the vendor, right? We sort of run into all of them, but those are definitely strong use cases as well.
Any other type of names that pop to mind? Like COBOL comes to mind. You know, there was a big article in the US some months ago with COVID that one of the states had they were looking for COBOL programmers. COBOL, yeah, programmers, because, you know, they couldn't handle the number of people, you know, needing benefits, you know, unemployment, that type of thing. You know, what are those, you know, kind of underlying technologies that these legacy applications, just they might be trigger words for people to go, you know what, I've heard of that in my company. This might be a way to solve some problems.
No, yeah, that is true. And I think that's another, you know, thing that Win Automation and Softomotive brings to the table for us as well. And it's really like some of those terminal applications. So it could be like those, you know, 3270, you know, applications, the green screens where you need to be able to do like the command line interface. And certainly, yeah, those are other opportunities as well. You know, I personally haven't run into a ton of those, but I know other colleagues that have. So I can definitely attest that they do exist. And that's another opportunity because you're definitely not integrating with APIs there. You're definitely not even creating a custom connector in those regards. So that's where, you know, going through the front end becomes the natural choice for you in order to be able to automate those scenarios.
So what were the real strengths in Softomotive and the company and with the Win Automation platform? What were the real strengths that you are leveraging quickly? And then what are some of the other strengths that company had, which are not necessarily on the roadmap now, but you find interesting?
I think a lot of the pre-built actions are interesting. And so, you know, there is this tendency when you hear about RPA is that you think it's all about recording. And recording is definitely plays a role. And just to clarify what recording is, it's essentially what you know, recording a macro. So people might have seen that before in Excel. Or even if they were doing some sort of like automated testing, like these would be, you know, common activities that you would perform. So it's this idea that if you needed to enter a transaction in the system, you would click the record button. It would record all of the keystrokes and basically the mouse clicks as you navigated through an application. And then you would hit stop. And then you can use tokens, you know, in order to basically do kind of find and replace and then put in your inputs. And that allows you to sort of dynamically drive future instances of that automation for that application. Yeah. And so, you know, sometimes you feel like that's a huge part of RPA and it is important, but it's almost like these other scenarios where you don't always have to record, right? Like, you know, Excel would have been an example where, you know, if you wanted to do some things in Excel with UI flows, you'd be recording that. And that isn't necessarily the best approach if you have access to an underlying like object model, right? And that's what essentially what these actions can do is they can tap into the object model that exists in Excel and then perform, you know, manipulations around, you know, being able to, you know, copy a cell, being able to find the first row of basically a spreadsheet. Whereas if you had to try to record that, like that's not going to be a lot of fun. So I think like the Excel, I've touched on that a little bit. It's really important. I would say the other thing that's, you know, the with Win Automation, it does provide this like rich debugger and it is like a local install. So you can go ahead and do a lot of like local debugging and do things like set breakpoints and obviously copy and paste and disable actions. And, you know, you've got all of those constructs like looping and conditions and things of that nature. So that's another very rich experience inside of what's now Power Automate Desktop. Things like around just like local file manipulations, file operations, PowerShell was another thing, right? So you can go ahead and execute PowerShell directly, which is nice. Like previously you'd be recording that. Once again, not the best experience, but now you can go ahead and say, I want to go run a PowerShell script. And so, you know, I always, you know, run into these situations and you see it a lot with Power Platform. It's like, oh, I need to automate Active Directory. So not Azure Active Directory, Active Directory, right? And then that's where people go, ooh, what am I going to do? Go write an Azure function. I need to do all of this stuff. No, you can just go ahead and run PowerShell. Yeah. And so that's another unique opportunity with Power Automate Desktop is tapping into some of those local scripting languages. Like we do support Python and VBScript and PowerShell. And so those provide some interesting extensibility stories as well.
Do you see a point, and in the bit of research I did do on Power Automate, they seem to, sorry, not Power Automate, the tool set that came from Soft Emotive was around, even at a desktop level, you know, the point where I could automate a whole bunch of stuff that happened in my email much more than what you get now as an individual, whether it be any type of activity, filling out timesheets, for example, which I might do on a, you know, it's the same thing, just different week in a different format, you know. Is it going to be that point with Power Automate that I can, you know, if there's a process that I click and I do it more than twice in a week, I could automate it?
Yeah, and I think that's where, like, that's where I feel like our architecture shines, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so for a lot of folks today, they're doing that, you know, using the connectors when they're in their inbox and they're able to, you know, get their attachments and, you know, persist them to OneDrive or, you know, ship them over to Teams, create adaptive cards. You know, have your form embedded on a tab in Teams. And so I think there's a lot of those like modern productivity use cases that exist, but there was always that last mile, which was difficult. Like I might be able to do like part of this, but now I got to go, you know, talk to that intranet application. Now what am I going to do? Right. And I think that's where it's the best of both worlds, right? Where you, if you're comfortable inside of that Office 365 world with Power Automate, great. Now go find the last mile. And then I think on the flip side, what we're seeing, especially with customers that are new to Power Automate but are familiar with RPA, they're like, wow, this is amazing. Because like there's basically a technique called human in the loop where, you know, you can obviously run executions like automations. And sometimes you need to bring a human in, right? Like if you're doing some sort of reconciliation and you detect a variance that's out of threshold, well, you have to stop the process. So how do you do that? And with some, you know, traditional RPA solutions that are out there, human in the loop is pretty difficult. But like with Microsoft, we have all of these great technologies around like even approvals, BPFs, Microsoft Teams posting an adaptive card, right? Like, so that's some of the feedback we've got where it's like, wow, I can now take these human in the loop scenarios and actually like go to town because of all of this like modern productivity that's part of the platform as well. And so I really feel like, you know, use the right tool for the job. I think in the past, some people with RPA, they're like, oh, I need to go in my inbox. I need to go find an email. Like I'm going to search for an email based upon like a subject. I'm going to then go find the email attachment. I'm then going to save it to a specific folder. And they go and record all of those steps. And it becomes a fairly lengthy process to do that.
Yeah.
Where it's like, well, no, in Power Automate, that's like one action or maybe two if I need to put it into OneDrive, right? But like those are a trigger and an action. Like those are like things that you can literally do in seconds. And so what we've seen with some customers is that they've been able to reduce the time it takes to build out these automations because they're taking advantage of these new paradigms. And that's obviously time is money. It's, you know, it's still true. But if you can reduce your dev cycles by like 75%, like that's some serious time saving, which ultimately leads to a lower cost solution as well.
Brilliant. Tell me about Magic Quadrant, where we're sitting and what you see. There's a movement for robotic process automation software.
So we did enter the Magic Quadrant where we're currently in the bottom right hand side at this point in time. But people are excited about it, you know, because it's obviously Magic Quadrants, you know, everyone has different feelings about it, but it is some level of validation. Like
Totally.
You know, so I think for Microsoft to appear there essentially in year one is a great sign of sort of where we're at and certainly how we're being viewed upon by both analysts, but also by the customers that are interviewed as part of those basically that feedback gathering by the analysts themselves. So I think it does validate that that we're on the right path. And certainly what I will say is like there's no one is complacent. There's no complacency right now when it comes to RPA. And so I fully expect big things from a Magic Quadrant perspective and certainly expect us to to move in the right direction from that perspective.
Yeah. Is it, you know, Microsoft has a range of products that they don't necessarily lead or dominate in when it comes to Magic Quadrant, but they are big, they're a big support to something else. So that therefore that's why Microsoft invests in them. Do you see as this is going to be one of those spaces, though, kind of like the Power Platform and low-code, no-code app development, we're kind of the leaders in that space. Do you see this also becoming really that topper right, you know, quadrant? Like that's the investment's going to be there. That's the goal is to. And I know it's, you know, subjective using this as an example, but it kind of gives me an idea of, you know, how serious Microsoft is about becoming the world leader in RPA.
Well, I'm not sure I'll make that bold of a statement, but there's absolutely appetite for more, right? Like yep. We're just getting started. I think, you know, I think the biggest thing is, you know, with Microsoft is we truly are a customer obsessed organization, mm-hmm. right? And so like we will meet our customers where they want to be met. Like that's a pretty mm-hmm. common saying by Satya, or famous saying by Satya. Mm. And it's very true, right? Like we do these, you know, customer advisory boards where we do bring in customers and we learn feedback and we take it seriously. And it really does have the opportunity to drive our roadmaps. And so we're going to do the right thing for customers and we're going to give them, you know, a very modern and productive experience. And we're also going to do that in a very low friction way, right? Like that's part of the reason why we do have cloud-based orchestration is we don't want to go ahead and have like huge, you know, infrastructure farms mm-hmm, being deployed mm-hmm. just to run this stuff. Naturally with desktop automation, you need a desktop, but you know, we're going to find ways to provide that as a SaaS service as much as possible. Cause that's really like the goal of the platform is to be that SaaS application. So, you know, time will tell, but, you know, I think what we've been able to demonstrate just even in the last 3 months is a great signal for other folks of how serious Microsoft is about this space. And, you know, I'm super pumped about Power Automate Desktop. I think, you know, what we have in preview, public preview right now is awesome and it's mm-hmm. only going to get better. And, I fully expect good things to come for Power Automate and Power Automate Desktop.
Awesome. Well, before we get started, some quick fire questions. Anybody that you would recommend from Microsoft to come on the podcast in future?
Oh, whew, that's a good one. Let me think about that some more. I would imagine, I know you've had some of the folks like Charles and Steven mm-hmm, and probably mm-hmm. Ryan on. Have you had Clay on at all? From
yeah, I have. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So I would imagine that would have been a good one as well.
Yeah. I could do a repeat on some of these because it's been over a year and a half since I've had a lot of these chaps on. So.
What about Evan Chackie? Have you had Evan on?
Yeah. Pretty
okay,
sure.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
That's so good. I'll let you think about it. You can hit me up later, maybe. But are you ready for some quick fire questions?
Let's do it.
They're random, right? They're random. So would you rather have a cook or a maid?
A cuckoo or a maid?
No, a cook. Somebody to cook or... sorry, my Kiwi there coming out rolling my words. So somebody to cook all your food or someone to clean up after you?
Oh my gosh, this is a tough one. This is a really tough one, but rapid fire. So I'm going to go with cook because I can deal with a mess.
Nice. If you could only keep three things from your home... If it was burning down, what three things would you keep? And we're not talking about family.
Oh, okay. So I would have to say my Surface Book mm-hmm. here, my mm-hmm. my laptop. Mm-hmm. I have I'm a bit of a sneakerhead. So mm-hmm. My Air Jordans. Mm-hmm. I have a fairly new pair of Air Jordans.
Nice.
I do enjoy. And then, you know, probably your phone. It's hard to live these days without your phone, so I'd probably take the phone as well.
Nice. You walk into a coffee shop. What do you order?
Oh, coffee shop. So I love coffee. I never go too far on the sugary side of things, but mm-hmm. Probably an Americano, right? Americano, no mm-hmm. cream, just dark and just ready to consume.
Love it. What's your favorite family tradition?
Favorite family tradition? So I would say... You know, every Christmas, we typically get together with my brother and his family. I've got a mm-hmm. twin brother. And we do head down to Arizona, and we call it the Weirzy Cup. Mm-hmm. So we go ahead, and it's usually him and one of my daughters against myself and another daughter, and we go ahead and we play soccer. And that's usually after, you know, watching some sort of football or bowl games you know, whatever is going on. So we usually make a day of it, and that's a pretty fun family tradition, yeah.
That's cool. That's cool. What are you most worried about the next generation?
The next generation, I think probably compassion, right? Like, I feel like, you know, especially with social media, you know, there's that tendency of, you know, all eyes on me, right? And, and just ensuring that we've got compassion. And I feel like, you know, certainly with a lot of the recent events that have occurred, like, compassion is hugely important, right? And, you know, I think that's, you know, it's been, you know, some of the sayings you hear, like, you know, it's not political, you know, to treat people well. You know, it's this is a human problem where we need to treat everybody well, properly, you know, regardless of their background. And I feel like, you know, there's a few different extremes when you talk about compassion, but I think just in general, you know, we need to make sure that we're looking out for each other and trying to make this place a better place to live.
Yeah, awesome. Ken, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Hey, thanks again for listening. I'm your host, Business Applications MVP Mark Smith, also known as the NZ365 Guy. If there's a Microsoft guest that you'd like to see on the show, please message me on LinkedIn. Please like and subscribe. If you want to leave a review, go to nz365guy.com/review for my current reviews and options to leave your own. See you next time.